It's time to introduce your baby to solids, and you haven't the foggiest idea of where to start. Or maybe you're researching in the future and wanting to learn more about baby-led weaning. On today's show, I interview Dr. Alyssa, founder of Thriving Foundations, an educational platform for parents to learn about this exact thing and more, on a holistic approach of food introduction to your baby via the method of baby-led weaning. We discuss when to start solids, how to prepare foods with this method, what some of the first ideal foods might be, and then the hot topic item of introducing food allergens and how to tell the difference between an allergen and an intolerance. We hope this episode leaves you feeling inspired and confident in feeding your baby with intention and as an important part of their overall health. Let's go.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Are you pregnant or trying to conceive and looking for reliable, engaging education around how to have a healthy pregnancy and prepare for the future aspects of motherhood to come, like birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum? Look, I've got you. This is exactly the education you'll receive with my 6-week pregnancy call. You get access to my most comprehensive resource of everything that I wish women knew before heading into motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 course, and postpartum planning class, all in one. And for 6 straight weeks, we meet for an hour each week on Zoom with a small group of like-minded women going through it too, for you all to ask me questions and get clarity from a trusted expert. I can walk through it with you and hold your hand. The 6-week pregnancy call is only offered 4 times a year, so get on the wait list now. Head to milkmedicine.com for more information or click the link in the show notes. Okay, so on the podcast today, we have Dr. Alyssa. Thank you so much for coming.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to finally be here.
I know. This is awesome. We've become good friends on Instagram recently, trying to, you know, just being similar in this world of having little kids and trying to have businesses and be entrepreneurs and do all the things. And it's in the motherhood space too, trying to just make things easier for our fellow moms. And so I really appreciate what you're doing. And I'm excited to have you on because there are a lot of questions that people have about food introduction with their children. But before we begin, I do want to just read a little bio so that the listeners know who you are. And you kind of have an interesting background too on this, which I love. So let me just read this so that everybody knows who you are. So Dr. Alyssa is a naturally minded doctor of pharmacy. Dun, 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 plot twist. The founder of Thriving Foundations and the creator of Holistic Baby-Led Weaning Course. Her mission is to help parents build strong foundations of health for their children from the earliest stages of life to ultimately prevent chronic disease. She advocates for a more holistic and intentional approach to starting solids, and she's passionate about empowering mamas to take ownership of their child's health. Woo woo, that's amazing. Thank you for doing that. And the reason why I say plot twist to the doctor of pharmacy is just because it is probably difficult for you to simultaneously hold both worlds when you're in the holistic natural health side of things, but then you're also so steeped in the pharmaceutical side of things, which, like, yes, we need the pharmaceuticals, of course. But that's such a, I just don't meet people. It seems like people are either, okay, if you had a background in pharmaceuticals, you'd probably think that natural medicine was total wackadoo, shamalama ding dong, you know?
Exactly.
So how do you not think that? Tell us about that first.
Oh my gosh, right? To be honest, I'm in this weird place where I had to accept. Sometimes I was like, I feel like I'm living as a fraud. But then I was like, it shouldn't be that way. Like, I should be able to embrace both, right? But how I ended up here, I was many years ago, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and the doctor pretty much told me there's really nothing you can do. It's not that serious. You just wait until your body attacks your thyroid and then you just take thyroid hormone, right? Pharmaceutical saves you. And I was like, what? Like, I literally just wait until my, an organ and no longer works. And then I just take a hormone the rest of my life. And that really just didn't sit well. So that kind of led to me looking outside kind of the box that I was being put in, I guess you could say, and looking at kind of the more holistic health world, functional medicine, that sort of thing. So that's kind of what led me there. And then while I was in pharmacy school, I took a few natural alternate. There was a college at my college. There is a college of, I don't even remember now. Oh my goodness. It was like alternative medicine type.
Yeah, like complementary and alternate CAM. Like it's called CAM, yeah. Complementary yeah. and alternative medicine. Yeah.
Yeah. Like a legitimate part of the college, right? School. And so I took a number of classes through that. And I mean, that was extremely eye-opening. Reading, I wrote a paper about, not to like digress, but it was about stress. Now I can't even think about it. But basically how like our mind reducing stress and how that impacted when they studied it in people with HIV, how it like reduced the viral load. Obviously, mindful-based stress reduction. That's what it was. So that was just kind of like opening my eyes to, wow, like the power of our mind. And just obviously there's more to it than that. But that was just kind of a little seed that was planted. And then the big one though was I took a cooking class that was taught by a physician and a chef. And every single Wednesday we got together and we talked, we made a meal, which was so incredible. I like a huge part of what I've learned when it comes to cooking is from that class. But we talked about how food impacts our health and how it leads to health or disease. And that class really kind of dove into really digging apart kind of the guidelines. So like the idea that saturated fats are bad, right? Was kind of really eye-opening because you had a physician who is sitting here talking about like this, no, this isn't, this is what kind of the guidelines have showed, but this is what, you know, the alternative, what the research shows. So that's kind of how I led to where I am as far as like having a more holistic view on health. And then really kind of as I've been practicing, I've been working in pharmacy for, oh my goodness, over 10 years now. And I've been licensed for, I think like six. I can't do fast math, but just kind of seeing the increase in pharmaceutical use among children has mm-hmm. been incredibly eye-opening. And then when I had my own kids, just realizing like I don't want chronic illness to be a part of their story. Obviously, like there's a time and a place for modern medicine. We have used it, and I'm so thankful when we've needed it. But
it can feel like a runaway train. Line, yeah, like it. We can. I think everyone can kind of admit and recognize that there's a problem right now in the way that this is being managed. And it isn't to say that it's mm-hmm. pharmaceuticals are the devil and blah blah blah. No, it's just that we can't be having. What I don't even know what the percentage is. I should look it up. But it's an extremely high percentage of children that are in first and second grade on ADD and ADHD meds. Like, no, mm-hmm. come on. We have to figure this out, you guys. So I think that's a completely reasonable conclusion for you to come to.
Yeah. And one in two children are dealing with at least one type of chronic illness. So that's kind of what led me to this and just realizing that ultimately the goal was like, how can we prevent chronic illness? And obviously it starts while pregnant, but for me, what really I was passionate about was first foods. Yep. It really comes down to that foundation that we are laying when we're starting them on solids. So,
and I bet that that class that you took with the physician and the chef was a pivotal mm-hmm. move for you with developing such an interest. And then of course, having your own children with specifically all of this baby-led weaning information and what Thriving Foundations is all about. And so I think it's so cool to think about the ways that these sorts of classes and different, you know, little stepping stones, milestones in our life and things that maybe we didn't realize at the time were going to shape us so much, but that was one of them. Yeah, so
absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that background. I love it. I just think it's fascinating getting to know why people are where they are and mm-hmm. where that sort of passion arises from, because it does take a lot of work, as you and I are always talking about in the, you know, online course building world. It's like, it is so much work, and you're also working full time. And then we both have you have three little kids. It's out of control, really. So we are obviously very driven. Otherwise we wouldn't do it because, it's hard, but so
passion. Yep.
I wanted to take this interview time to make a resource, an episode that listeners can figure out and learn. Well, not figure out, but I mean, they can learn about baby-led weaning, from somebody who is such an expert who has courses on this, and your whole shtick is this bit, which I love. And I want them to have good takeaways from it. And then I also wanted to spend some time speaking about, because I did a poll, and as you guys know, and I mentioned this a lot on the podcast, but I just really want listeners to know that your questions that you guys ask us when we put up question boxes about potential podcast episodes that we're going to have, we really take all of this to heart. And so one of the repeated questions that we saw again and again when I mentioned that this episode was coming up was about allergens. Parents are very concerned, you know, how do I introduce the allergen foods? When? How can I tell the difference between an allergy or an intolerance, et cetera? And I know that your course goes into this. And your course, by the way, is amazing. I'm probably going to talk about it throughout the entire thing. But I think that you really underplay and downplay how awesome it really is and how many downloads, how many supplemental guides and recipes. And I mean, the whole thing is just, it's out of this world. So slam dunk to you. 5 out of 5 stars, 10 out of 10 stars.
Oh,
it's really great. So let's just start talking about the whole thing. Baby-led weaning. If nobody knew what it was, how would you describe it to somebody who's hearing about this term for the first time?
Perfect. Okay. And if you heard crying in the background, I apologize. My husband has all 3 kids in the basement and I just heard all 3 of them screaming. So I texted him while you were talking and I was like, is everything okay?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have my baby asleep right here and it looks like she might be awake. So we'll have to just take this as much as we, you know, do what we can.
If we have to pause, we'll come back. Yes. So essentially baby-led weaning is just a method of starting solids where we are letting our baby lead the way. So just kind of a visual, if you think about kind of the more traditional way of feeding a baby solids, when we think about probably the way our parents and grandparents think about it, is you have your little jar of puree and you're scooping it into their mouth, and they might be 4, 5 months, maybe 6 months. And that's one way to introduce solids. Baby-led weaning is where we're really waiting for them to show us that they are ready. And I always like, it can feel so overwhelming and there's just so much to think about. But I love it because you really can take a step back and just like go into it with ease and trust your baby and your intuition. And I know that's easier said than done, but really you can, like, it's when it comes to starting, you really are waiting until your baby can, one, sit up, because obviously they have to be able to sit up if they're going to be feeding themselves. If you think about trying to like slump over in a chair, you can't really eat, right? Like that's one, it's not safe or going to be easy for them. And so we're really just waiting until they're showing us that they are ready. And then we are letting them lead the way. So that looks like they're putting food in their mouth. They are determining what and how much they're going to eat. And that's really the gist of it. Like they are a part of they're joining us at the table and we're trusting them. We're letting them kind of lead the way. And the whole weaning thing really came from in the UK. Weaning means to, that's hard to say. It's like a tongue twister. It means to like gradually start solids or complementary foods. Whereas in the US, we think about weaning as like stopping breastfeeding or stopping milk. That's not the case. When you are starting baby-led weaning, really for the first 12 months of baby's life, so up until age one, milk should be their primary source of nutrition. We're just like gradually starting solids. So,
and I think that sometimes, thank you for explaining that. I think too, sometimes people think, okay, well, I'm going to start baby-led weaning when my kid is 6 months. And maybe in their mind, they have this image of 3 meals a day and lots of intake and whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's just not like that. It's a very long, at least in my experience, it's a very long period of time, months even, where the child is really intaking very little and it progressively becomes more and more. But because you're giving the food prepared in a certain way, and we'll talk about that in a second, there's not a lot of actual intake. It's like textures and flavors. And like you said, sitting at the table with the family, I think all of these little things are important. And because we're waiting till they're showing the signs, you know, they're strong enough to at least hold their own core up and their bodies up and being able to sit. I did have a question about that actually. Do you think that a baby that can mostly sit upright by themselves is ready for it? Or do you think that, like, no, you need to be able to plop the child down in an like on the floor and they support themselves very well and they're not falling over at all? Where do you think that line is?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's kind of a gray area, and I tend to really empower moms to lean into their intuition and like lean into what feels right for them. So like my son, our babies are really close. My son can sit up really well when he's sitting in our lap. I have not tried to sit him in a chair yet. I personally wait until they can get their little booty from lying down on the floor into a sitting position. So that's a little bit later for us. We usually start around probably around 7-ish months. I did with both my boys, maybe 7.5. That way too, it tends to be like they're like really ready. You know, they're starting to really go at it. But that doesn't mean that you can't start. I think in general, if a baby is in a well-supported high chair, especially if they're like strapped in, the goal is that we just don't want them to be focusing on like trying to keep themselves up while they're trying to safely eat. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. That so makes it sense.
Probably depends on like the high chair and just kind of like how they're sitting in it. But really I would just say like, as long as your baby seems like their trunk is well supported, it's okay.
You're totally right. Because I mean, even once a baby can quote unquote sit up, there are still times where they kind of like just lose their balance. They fall down, and that's, right. And that could be a like 8-month-old, 9-month-old baby who falls down sometimes. Like it doesn't have to be 100% all the time. So that's a good distinguisher. Thank you for saying that. Okay. So then I wanted to circle back, because for people who don't know, also there is a difference, a very major difference between traditional puree feeding and baby led weaning, in that you're giving the baby, in a baby led weaning sense, whole pieces of food. And they are mm-hmm. prepared in a certain way. And so can you give some examples of that in these sort of early phases for like a 6 to 8 month old? What are some of the ways that the baby would be presented the food, and what would you sort of expect them to be doing with it? You know, because some kids will grab it and put it to their mouth. Maybe some of them won't. Who knows? Can you just talk about that for a bit?
Yeah. So I think it's important too for parents. This is like the biggest thing that I reassure parents, that all of the things that lead up to them actually eating are important. So them playing with it, them mashing it, them rubbing it all over their face and hair.
It's the worst.
Throwing it over the high chair. Like, yes, when you're like, I just made this for you, why are you not eating it? But to them, it's a step. They're called pre-feeding behaviors. If any OTs that are listening to this will be like, yes, pre-feeding behaviors. So they're all things that like, it's a natural part of learning how to eat, right? Babies have never like put food in their mouth. That's why it's so important to like bring them to the table so that they can see us modeling that. Up until now, they've just done the suck swallow, right? So they don't know what like all these weird textures and things are. So they will not eat a lot in the beginning. But when it comes to, yes, the kind of how we're preparing the food, this is where it just comes down to doing a lot of education, reading about like how to make sure the food is safe. The biggest thing though that is like really hard for parents, moms to wrap their mind around is when you are first starting, the bigger pieces, you want them to be kind of relatively, not the right shape, but like the size of like 2 adult fingers, right? You want your baby to be able to like hold on to it, because in general, babies they don't have that pincer grasp when they're first starting. So they're going to grab onto the whole thing and they're just going to kind of like bring it to their mouth. So if you have like small little, I laugh because when I think back to the first time we did solids with my oldest, I looked at, like, I have a picture of it because I was so excited, and I had a tray full of like cut up little tiny blueberries, and I'm like, I don't actually know if he was able to, because it's probably frustrating because he doesn't have the pincer grasp and he's just like probably smashing it all around the place, which is probably fun for him. But the thing with babies that are first starting, you want the food in general, the bigger pieces are better than smaller. One, it's easier for them to hold on to, but two, it helps them get a mental map, I guess you could say, of their mouth. Like as they're, and this is why babies teeth as well, or like chew on teethers. I mean, it's doing the same thing, right? But when it comes to eating, as well, it's more likely a bigger piece, a bigger, like a chicken wing, for example, right, is more likely to trigger the gag reflex than like a tiny little blueberry. A blueberry is like more likely to probably make its way past the tongue to the back of the throat, right? So yeah. In general, bigger pieces, I know it like freaks parents out, but that is safest. So you see like the longer pieces of carrot, you want them to be soft enough that they can like squish it, you know, between their tongue and their palate or between their gums. And I'm trying to think what else.
Yeah, it needs to be like cooked enough. So if it's like a sweet potato fry shape or a carrot yep. fry shape or like a big spear of avocado that mm-hmm. an avocado is so hard to hold. So I often see people will like roll them in, you know, like mm-hmm. Powdered like flaxseed or something like that yep. so that it creates a little bit of a rougher texture for them to grab onto. And then do know, and I think this is a huge part of this whole thing, and I'll tell you like what I've done with my kids too in a second, but a huge part of this is understanding gagging versus choking.
Yes.
Can
yes.
you outline this for people who are not yes. really like aware of the normalcy of gagging? I think too is really hard for parents. It freaks yes. them out.
Yes.
As is understandable.
Yes. So absolutely, if you are a mom or a dad, maybe there's dads listening, but absolutely read and watch videos of babies gagging, but read and learn and understand the difference, because there is a huge difference. And when you understand and you know how to respond, that is key. So gagging is a normal, it's a protective reflex. It is our baby's way of closing their throat and pushing their tongue forward to move something forward and out of the mouth. Babies who are, there's a study that I think it was it the Bliss study? I'm totally going off of memory, but there's a study that looked at babies that were started on solids doing baby led weaning. And then those that were started, I assume traditional like purees, and the baby led weaning babies did gag more in the beginning, but then later on they gagged less. So this is kind of why too, and gosh, there's so much to talk about, but this is why it is important to start solids or start finger foods by, I typically say at least around 9 months. There's kind of a window of time. There's a lot that happens during that time. But one of the things is the gag reflex is super sensitive, but that's a good thing because we want our babies to be pushing things out and forward, being a little bit more, you know, sensitive to that as they get older, that the point of if at which, I don't know if that makes sense, it is triggered, moves back, if that makes sense. So like right, younger like babies. Reflex,
yeah, it's not so anterior. It's not like as sensitive because it's not as far yes. forward on the tongue. It's further back. And so yes. then if you're, I think what you're saying, correct yes. me if I'm wrong, is that like if we miss this window to get them to practice having it and get good at gagging and manipulating food in their mouths, then it mm-hmm. will be maybe potentially harder and more dangerous for them later.
Yeah, that's like one of the tiny reasons why I advocate for like starting by 9 months. But yeah, so gagging. And the key though is I cannot tell you how many course students I've had that get so freaked out by it and they will reach inside their baby's mouth and take the food out. That is, please do not do that. And the reason is if you think about it, like unless you are tipping your baby upside down and opening their mouth to let it fall out, because you're so freaked out, like I'd rather a mom do that than reach inside. Because if you're reaching inside, there's a potential that you're shoving it back further.
Yes, right? 100%.
When your baby is gagging, if they're making noise and they're red or they're coughing, they can breathe and they're doing their thing. The key is staying calm and telling them, like you want to be there sitting. You don't want to just give them food and go cook dinner. You want to be there with them. And I always just remind them, wow, good job, bud. You're doing exactly what you need to be doing. Like give them that reassurance. You know, they might not fully understand, but you need to stay calm so that your baby doesn't freak out. Because we don't want them to develop kind of an aversion to every time I gag, my mom freaks out and grabs food out of my mouth.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that CPR for parents is an important and necessary thing for us to know anyway. Do you have to go take like a Red Cross class? Not necessarily, but I think having mm-hmm. some of those tools will help reassure parents of what to do. And CPR backs this up 100% that you're never supposed to reach inside of somebody's mouth if they're choking. you just are doing the back blows, you're holding it depending on the age of the person or the child. But I it can be kind of tricky, especially when their mouth is big and open and wide and you can see it in the back of their throat and they're going,
yeah.
But if they're making those noises, that's good, because choking is silent. That is not choking. That is gagging. And the baby, just give them a minute, stay calm. Like you said, you got to just kind of breathe and watch them and know and trust. And then when they will push and move it out of their mouth, but it takes a second. When they're doing that, like, what is actually happening is the back of the throat, the pharynx is coming together closer, and it's actually protecting the airway, and it's creating these little puffs of air that are starting to kind of like push it out forward, and they're trying to get it a little bit further onto the tip, towards the tip of their tongue, so that they can then thrust it out. And it can be freaky. And listen, if this is like not for you, then it's not for you, and that's okay. And to what I was saying earlier is that we, with all four of, well, we haven't started with the fourth yet, but we're going to in like a week. But with the other three, there's a period of time where we do baby-led weaning for the first like maybe 2 months. And then maybe it's like, yeah, around 8 months. I always forget exactly what it is. But there is a time where it gets a little too freaky for me, because they're getting a lot more comfortable. They're like putting much bigger chunks in their mouth. There's just this window of time where I don't stop it completely, but I do bring in more purees or mashed up, or I'm like doing that thing where I'm mostly mashing up like some avocado and then I'm loading a spoon and then letting them eat that or something. But just because it, there is a period where I get to be like, my stress level of it is not worth it. So I kind of revert back until then that pincher grasp comes into play around like 9 months, where they can, 9 months where they can pick it up with their thumb and their forefinger and put the food and littler pieces in their mouth. And then we, you know, we just, it just flies off the rails from there and it is all good. But it can be like really affronting. But I think too, we just need to know that it's normal, it's good, and it's working on a very important reflex.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with all of that. And but do more reading for those listening. Absolutely. Do more reading. So, you know, don't just like take this tiny podcast episode, this tiny, you know, like 10 minutes that we're speaking on it. Really educate yourself, because that's like, that's the biggest thing that parents are freaked out about. And probably one of the most important things, that there are ways to minimize the risk for choking. So,
okay, awesome. And what would you say is sort of the ideal timing to introduce the foods? Like what age, in your opinion?
Yeah, when to start. So, I mean, the number one thing is just to wait until baby is showing all signs of readiness. That is, if you're doing baby-led weaning. Most of the major health organizations now are kind of in agreement that that should be done at like no earlier than 6 months. But I mean, people, it's not really a hill I'll die on, because I always say you know your baby better than anyone else, right? I personally wait until after that. So around that age. And then, yeah, I think just all the signs of readiness, and I think that answers.
And yeah. And,
right?
And it's an intersection between age sort of plus readiness. Yeah, that makes sense. And what about, okay, I know that this is going to be something that everybody wants to know, is ideal first foods, like the types of foods. And in your course, you talk so much about all of the nutrients, nutrient density, the different types of things, the different, you know, all of this. It's so good. It's such, it's like a health course, really.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's not just baby-led weaning. But so
I was just going to say, can we go back to talking about when to start? I wanted to mention
reasons to
not like wait too long. So this is something that I see, especially kind of in the holistic health space, crunchy moms, whatever. A lot of moms I've heard are like, I'm going to wait until my baby's one, or until my baby has molars. Even like some will wait past a year. I strongly recommend doing some research before making that decision, because I said I like to start by 9 months. So there's like this window of time that, one, they're more open to eating literally anything. You can give them anything and they'll eat it. So they kind of have this like flavor taste window where they're kind of, you have an opportunity to influence and help them develop taste preferences to foods you want them to be, you know, comfortable, familiar with. The other thing is like texture. They have this like sensitivity to textures. And then also there's like this window of, looking at my notes so I didn't forget. There's like this window of time that they can they're developing these oral motor skills in chewing. So some parents will find that if they wait too long and they're starting after a year, they're like, my baby doesn't chew. My baby just puts food in his or her mouth and they just kind of like move it around and they might swallow it whole. And so there is this, it's a window of time that they're learning these skills. And so it's just important. And then the texture thing is a big one. If we're only giving baby purees for, you know, the first year of life, they're not, not that they're going to prefer purees, but it can lead to some problems where they prefer them and they, you can have a hard time getting them to try different textures. So
later on. Well, yeah. I mean, think about it. It's like, how different of an experience is it? Oh, there's just like so many things I want to say. There, how different of an experience is it to, for a, let's just say like an 8-month-old to have a piece of steamed broccoli on the plate and like a chicken leg and, or like a strip of steak, which, you know, they're probably not going to get that much of it in their mouth, but they're going to suck on the juices and taste it and everything. And then, yeah, some like sweet potato kind of strips or something like that to be able to have this sensory experience. You know, we're all about sensory integration and giving your child lots of opportunities with that as toddlers. But we need to remember that this is also important in this little babyhood time period and how rich of a sensory experience eating can be. And picking up something like a piece of broccoli, and you know, they're going to like kind of fist it. They're just going to grab it and put it in their mouth like a ball. And all those little florets and the way that they feel on the tongue and the flavor and recognizing and seeing the color and then looking at, you know, the bright green and then looking at the bright orange sweet potato and it's soft and it's mashed and it's a little bit sweet. Mm-hmm. And then looking at this piece of steak or whatever it is, and it's kind of like umami flavor. It's a little salty, or it's a, you know, they're just kind of sucking on it. And having that experience versus just having foods, all, it could be even all three of those maybe blended up together. You never get to see them separately. You don't even know what it is that you're eating. And yeah. Yes, I know these are babies. Like sometimes when I'm picking apart these concepts and ideas, I can see how the people who are maybe like rolling their eyes at this, they're like, oh my God, like relax. It's a 7-month-old baby. Like, what are you talking about? This does not matter for your life. And it's like, I can understand why it could seem insignificant. I think, though, that if we are on the side of trying to be intentional and optimize situations, we can't pretend that it doesn't matter later on with the flavor window and the palate, like making or giving a child an experience of real whole foods and not processed foods from like the very, very get-go of their life. Mm-hmm. And having them develop a good positive, even if it's subconscious, because yes, they're not going to necessarily remember, but all of these experiences build on each other. You can't just have like a blank tape. Nothing happens to a child for the first 5 years of their life. And then all of a sudden you just come from that point. And then, yeah, now they have memories. And it's like, okay, well, that first 5 years of their life mattered a lot. So whatever mm-hmm. happened in that time mattered a lot for the way that they're going to be as, you know, healthily, you know, securely attached, emotionally attuned adults or whatever it is. And same thing with eating and our eating habits and patterns. And it really does start from the beginning. And even as parents, when we, I don't want to like, I'm not trying to bash this situation because again, I use purees. I use the packets. I will be the girl at the park and watch me in 4 months squeezing a packet into my baby's mouth, trying to get her to eat it something really fast. Like I will do it 100%.
And that's okay. Right?
It's okay. I try not to do it all the time, but I will be doing that. So like I, you know, we can have both and in this conversation, but I have to say though, as a parent, when we can be like, wrap our mind around the idea of being intentional in the way that we prepare food for our children, knowing that it does matter, it keeps us accountable and it keeps us on track too for continuing to not get lazy with it, continuing mm-hmm. to not lean into American child food culture, which is just absolute shit. And like
the industry that wants us to buy their purees. They're yes, stage and one, two, or whatever.
Like, yes, and it's like,
we don't need these.
No. I mean, it's like, guys, let's just go back. It's actually simpler to just give the baby the food that you're eating. Like you're already going to be making the broccoli for your family, or maybe you're not, but you should be because broccoli is good for you or whatever it is. So then just before you put on any of the spices or whatever, put a slab, a couple pieces down for your baby on the high chair.
Put the spices on.
Or maybe, yeah, exactly. Put the spices on. I mean, think about children who grow up in India and there's tons of seasonings and culture, like, you know, curries and amazing flavors. Children that grow up in Southeast Asian cultures with tons of really, like, to us would seem like really unique, you know, food and seafood and different things, whatever. Of course, that's what the food that they're growing up on. Mm-hmm. American children, I mean, we grow up on, we're going to
macaroni.
Not...
I've turned my 2.5-year-old into a macaroni and applesauce animal.
Yes. it's hard not to.
Yeah.
It's like that's all they want. And we need to remember, like you said too, that babies are in this exploratory window of like, give them the sauerkraut and the sardines and the things and the liver, the bone marrow and the stuff that you think is probably really gross, but they don't know that and they don't think that. And if it's a nutrient dense food that you probably wish that you had in your diet, but you just can't stomach it because it's gross, then this is your perfect time for you to be giving this to your kid, because maybe they will end up liking. I mean, my 3-year-old would drink the entire sauerkraut juice jar if you let her.
Yeah.
And, so you know, amazing. There is personality dependent things too, because like some kids are going to be a lot more adventurous than others. But anyway, I just had to like kind of go off on that tangent because I think this does matter in the end of the day. Yep. This is a microcosm to the macrocosm of the way that we are living in life in this modern world. And it even comes down to the examples of the way that we're giving nutrition to our babies as their first foods. So speaking of that, first foods, what are your, like, talk to us about that. And now a moment from our sponsor. If you are looking for a delicious and effective immune supplement that your entire family can use, from children through adults and even while pregnant and breastfeeding, look no further than the needed immune support powder. With elderberry, zinc, pre and probiotics, beta-glucans, and arabinogalactans, the needed immune support powder is a very tasty berry treat that you can easily mix into water, yogurt, popsicle recipes, smoothies, gummies, and more. It's something that I always have on hand and give at the first sign of illness to any of my children as well as myself. Give it a try by visiting thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%.
Okay, back to the show.
Yeah, and I have a free guide on this. We can link it. Ooh, it's like the suggested first foods. Obviously, this depends on your lifestyle, your kind of beliefs, your culture. It all depends on like what's important for your family. So these are not perfect first foods. These are just ones that I like. But I think when I would say intentional first foods, and yes, this means literally like their first foods, but also it is kind of like encompasses like the first 2 years of their eating journey, I guess you could say. So foods that are, obviously I talk about liver, foods that are high in, that have iron, bioavailable iron. Iron's extremely important for babies, especially. I know this was the question about like if my baby is not, it was one of the questions that got submitted for you. If my baby's not eating a lot, how do I make sure they get enough iron? Well, it would, for me, it's just focusing on those foods that are high in bioavailable forms of iron, right? I know that like legumes and lentils have iron, but realistically, the amount that our baby would need to eat to get the iron they need is not realistic. So I'm not saying that those aren't okay, and that, you know, if someone's vegan and they want to raise their baby that way, then I'd probably recommend considering an iron supplement. Obviously, like work with someone that can help you dose that right. But iron is incredibly important. Foods that have fat.
Right? Okay, wait, really quick. Sorry, I have to just interject this about the iron thing and babies. I think I'm a little bit more hardcore about this, and I might get some flack about this, but I do not think that children should be raised vegan. And not that saying that you should think that they should, but I know that you're trying to be like respectful of it. And I can in one breath be respectful. And I think that if it's an education issue, if your adult self has a fundamental problem with eating meat products, okay, that's fine. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. But a child, this is my opinion. Okay, I'm not saying this is yours, but I really, really do think that it comes down to an educational standpoint with parents, unless it's a very, very deep religious thing. Okay, fine. But we cannot try to pretend that the nutrient density is the same, especially for babies and children, of these, you know, just plants and fruits and a plant-based diet. And it is extremely hard to get proper iron from a plant-based diet for a child that is growing so rapidly and needs so much of the omega-3s and the vitamin A that is in the proper form. They need a retinol mm-hmm. form, not mm-hmm. a beta-carotene form. Mm-hmm. 40% of the population cannot even convert beta-carotene to mm-hmm. retinol.
Yeah.
So it's like, what do we think is going to be happening here, you guys? If we're getting non-heme sources of iron, it's very tough for the body to, yeah, I mean, yes, I guess then you're just leaning into supplementation, which is going to be extremely important. You need to be working with your doctor on this, because we just need to try to like keep this in perspective that children who can't be making these decisions on their own should be mm-hmm. given the food ideally that is going to be best suited for them and their development. And in my opinion mm-hmm. and everything that I know and have researched, a lot of that is going to be animal-based. I personally also think this is true of pregnancy. But I know that, you know, as an adult woman, if you are, whether it's a religious or a philosophical belief during your pregnancy, you may not choose to do that. But again, I think that it's different with children because they are not able to choose the foods themselves. And so anyway, I just have to say that, but I might get some talk about that. That's okay. We can talk about it. We can have a discussion.
No, that was honestly, I am happy you brought that up, because with my first, I was like drinking my almond milk and my protein powders. And I was like, yeah, we're probably gonna, we might, I don't even know. I wouldn't say I was a vegan, but I was just kind of like falling into that, I guess, way of eating. And as I was creating my course in one of the lessons, I don't know if you covered this, but that is essentially the, I think it's module 3. I walk through the major nutrients that are important for babies and then outline or and then just list like the most nutrient dense food or the foods that are, you know, have the highest amount of those. And for me, it was very clear. I was like, okay, so take emotions out of it. My baby needs these nutrients. Yep. Which foods are high in these? Okay, those are the foods I'm going to give my baby, right?
Right.
And I think it is important, like you said, because it's within the first 5 years of life, our baby's brain grows to 95% of its like adult size, which is insane. And what do babies need? They need fat, right? Like we need to be aware of the nutrients that they need, because it literally is this critical it's window. Not that we need to get like panicked about it, yes. But we just need to understand what, or this is kind of what I advocate for. We have to be aware of what nutrients they need and what foods are rich in them. And I actually don't I don't know if you watched the, there's one lesson in the course that dives into supplements and breaks down. It is like so in depth. And I literally give like risks and benefits. And iron is actually one of them that I'm not an advocate for blanket supplementation. Same. We know that there can be risks. And if a baby is like iron replete, right? They have enough iron. There can be risks with supplementing. Now, I'm not saying that to try and scare parents, but I just think like my goal is to help. I essentially walk through like these are the different supplements, and like although kind of I feel like a lot of providers, pediatricians will just be like, give your baby, you know, XYZ. These are the supplements they need, and I don't think that that's right in my opinion, because I think that they're not every baby is going to need those. But yeah, I was just I plugged the iron supplement because it is so important, and yeah, if a mom is feeding their baby vegan, then I would say just do a little bit more research. And obviously we can't tell a parent or, you know, mom how to feed, but I think at the end of the day, if you understand what they need, what their growing brains and bodies and nervous system needs, it can be very challenging getting that strictly from plants.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're not sure where your baby's, you know, iron levels are at when they're in that last, in the between 6 and 12 months, somewhere in there, your pediatrician's office can do a little finger prick hemoglobin mm-hmm. to see. You know, there is this whole thing, breast milk is kind of low in vitamin D, breast milk's low in vitamin iron, but there is a huge iron loading of the fetus in the third trimester. So mom's levels being set, you know, at that time is important too. And even if mom's levels can be low, the baby might be able to get what they need, but mom is, you know, just continuing to suffer with that. Sometimes that's how it goes. So there's a lot of different factors that happen into this. But okay, so iron-rich foods are on one of the tops of your list for some of the first foods. What else would you say for that?
Foods that are high in fat. So you've got avocados, bone marrow, right? Fats are so incredibly important, and not necessarily the fats that are dietary mainstream dietary guidelines recommend. I think I have a post on Instagram and it's, what is it, 50 or 60% of the fat in breast milk is in the form of saturated fat. So kind of like my mantra, as you go through the course, if you haven't heard it already, when in doubt, turn to nature. So like for me, yes. When I was starting to feed my baby, I was like, okay, I'm just going to tune out all the noise from what the dietary guidelines are telling me, which, by the way, they say vegetable oil is nutrient dense and butter is not. So I'm sorry, you lose all credibility. Yeah. Like, yep. What? Just yep. Bizarre.
Out. Be gone. Be gone with you. No, we reject that.
So do not. Yes. So, okay. So anyways, fat. Yes. Like I said, baby's brain is growing to 95%. It is so important. Even past it's mind-boggling that I think at 2 years, pediatricians or the dietary recommendations, pediatricians are telling parents, okay, start giving your baby fat-free milk now at 2 years old. It's crazy. Yeah. Yep. So all this to say, I like, there are some amazing pediatricians. Our pediatrician is amazing. But all this to say, educate yourself. I hear my children screaming downstairs. As moms, we just have to, I think there's so much out there. There's a lot of money involved in lobbyists and things that when it comes to our health and recommendations and guidelines, it's not necessarily like our baby's health is at the, you know, center of those. So that's why I think as moms, our baby's health is at the center of everything. Maybe not everything we do, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like we will do what they need. So anyways, fats. What else? I advocate, this is kind of the where I talk about the holistic approach. I advocate for foods that are being mindful about digestion and gut health. And there's kind of like two parts to that. One that we can talk about, which is kind of interesting. The idea that a baby's gut is leaky gut. We know that is true. Babies are born with leaky gut. You could say that's good. That allows proteins and nutrients to easily pass, you know, from breast milk into the baby's, through the baby's gut. But what's interesting to me, and if anybody knows this, please reach out to me. This idea that a baby's gut is leaky for like the first year of life or longer. I cannot tell you, I have done so much digging and I've read so many articles and research papers and I cannot find clear evidence on this. So I don't promote that. I don't tell parents like your baby's gut is super leaky. And so like, I don't want to scare parents if that makes sense. Like mm-hmm. I do like to look at, hey, what does the research actually say? That being said, obviously we don't have a good way of studying that. So I think that it's good to be mindful. Hey, let's focus on those foods that have nutrients that are important for the gut integrity. So like vitamin A and zinc, those are nutrients that help promote, you know, the integrity of our epithelial cells or the gut lining. Were you going to say something?
No, I was just, I'm nodding along. This is great. Yeah.
So foods, like focusing on those foods, focusing on supporting the gut in that way. And then also the microbiome. I sent you a message the other day and I was like, this is like the spark that just lights me on fire. Nobody in the baby-led weaning space, at least like the big, huge accounts, are talking about the microbiome, which we know it's, the research has shown that our baby's microbiome is more or less established by age, I think it's 2 or 3. Okay. And the microbiome influences so many things, our risk for food allergies, our risks for certain other health conditions. It is so incredibly important. Eczema, allergies, right? Asthma. So our microbiome is so important and no one is talking about it. And I mean, obviously people are talking about it, but this is where kind of like I'm a huge advocate for foods that are going to help. Obviously, it doesn't come down, it's not just about foods when it comes to the microbiome, but being mindful about that and being intentional about foods that help support that. So that's why sauerkraut is, right? We love sauerkraut. Sauerkraut is packed with probiotics. What other foods?
Like being kefir mindful or yogurt.
Say that again?
Like kefir or yogurt, like yep. Some kind of a dairy-based one too is a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I like to start with the cultured. When doing dairy, starting with the cultured dairy, it can just be, for some babies, easier to digest. So I like to start with like the yogurts and, like you said, the kefir, and then kind of work your way up. Egg yolks. People are always like the egg thing. People are always, I don't know. I just answered a question about this. People always panic when they're like, oh, I gave my baby a whole egg. I'm like, it's okay. In general, the egg whites tend to be more allergenic. So some babies tolerate egg yolks a little bit better. That being said, if someone gave their baby egg whites or the whole egg and they made an omelet and their baby tolerated it, cool. That's the goal, right?
Go for it. Yeah.
But if you know, if your baby kind of gets a little, maybe breaks out in a little rash or spits up or just seems a little digestively unsettled when you give them whole egg, try the yolk. The yolks are also the nutrient dense part. So like I'll make a little baby omelet that's like literally just yolk, like a yolk and a tablespoon of bone broth, and just like make a little baby omelet. Broth, meat stock, people will go round and round about that. I think both are nutritious.
And doing something too, like once your baby has had these foods, and there's so much that we're not talking about on this podcast. Yeah. So I want you guys all to look into Dr. Alyssa's programs if you're wanting more information, for sure. But once your baby has safely been introduced to each of these different foods individually, and you know that they vibe well with your body, baby's body, making like a little kind of like mash with maybe avocado and bone broth and like egg yolk together. And then they can be, as they become older and older, say they're like 10 months or whatever, and then they're starting to manipulate, or they're just scooping it into their mouths, or it's getting on their hands, or you can even load up one of those like little feeder things. But there is ways to, because broth, it's like, well, how do you feed a baby broth? People think, I think like it would have to be in a soup or something, but no, you can just add it in to the cooking process, or it can be maybe a little bit in like a bit of an open cup that they're mm-hmm. going to just mostly pour all over themselves, but some of it will get in their mouth, and it's more about the taste, the flavor, the experience. Like, it really is so true. But okay, you started to mention allergens, and I do want to mm-hmm. talk about this, because it was probably the most frequent question was how and when to start with the allergen foods, because you hear all the research that's like 4 to 6 months, 4 to 6 months. And I'm like, whoa, hang on. Well, like, what
that
are we
ship
doing?
Ship sailed.
Yeah, yeah. Like, are we giving? Yeah, exactly. That ship sailed for you and me. And I actually messaged you about this the other day. I was like, wait a minute, because Sunny has this seemingly strong egg intolerance when I eat it through the breast mm-hmm. milk, and then she had like maybe some bit of eczema on her cheeks, which has completely resolved since I've taken out the eggs. I was like, kind of freaking out, asking you, do you think I should have been doing more of these allergen introductions earlier, because I have not yet. And then we had this conversation. So that is a little nuance again that you go over in the course. We don't need to go there right now, but I just mm-hmm. want you to talk about, for listeners, what's the deal with the allergen foods? Should we be giving them? Should we not be giving them? What are they? And what's your sort of like opinion on all of this?
Yeah. So I will say that the, as of right now, the research is very clear that there is a benefit to introducing allergens early and often to help reduce the risk for developing a food allergy in babies who are, this is key, high risk. Now, yes, you can apply this to, I guess, moderate risk, whatever. But just to kind of take a step back and say why. Like, this is all I hear. I need to unfollow a lot of baby led weaning accounts, because this is all I hear. And it is important. The reason I think there's a lot of this education out there, which is absolutely a good thing, is back, 20 years ago, pediatricians would tell parents to wait to introduce, because it was thought that if you give them early that it would cause. And so they would wait. Now there's a big landmark study, the LEAP study, that looked at peanuts and introducing them early and often to babies who were high risk. It helped to reduce their risk of developing an allergy. But wait, this is where I'm like, okay, there is more to the story. So the whole, like the, not the mechanism, but I guess you could say the mechanism. When we're introducing early and often, what is that doing? It's helping our baby to build a tolerance. Okay. A baby like my son right now is low risk. And like you said, my course covers this, but you can also find this information out there. Right now, the kind of the what makes a baby high risk is if a baby has severe eczema or they have a current food allergy. My son is not high risk. So if I wait to introduce peanuts, I'm not going to give him a, he's not going to become allergic to peanuts because I didn't give him peanuts, if that makes sense. I know this kind of gets a little like fuzzy, but what I'm trying to say here is there is more to the story, I guess you could say, and taking this more holistic approach to understanding like, okay, but why are our babies high risk in the first place? What's making them susceptible? And the reason I think this is so important is because I think the stat is 40%. I had it. It's like 40% of about 40% of children with food allergies are allergic to more than one food. Okay. So that tells us that there's something going on in our body that is making us, if we have one food allergy, it's kind of making us more susceptible to another. It's kind of like autoimmune disease, right?
Right.
And so the reason that I want parents to understand that the importance of taking this holistic approach, supporting the gut, supporting the microbiome is when we're introducing early and often, that's just for that specific allergen. Right? So you have to do peanuts, you have to do wheat, you have to do all these allergens early and often. And it just then is specific to it's helping them build the tolerance to that specific food. It's not like reducing their overall susceptibility to allergic disease in general, if that makes sense. So like babies that have food allergies, it's common for them to also have other allergic disease like eczema and asthma. And so it's like there's more to the story, if that makes sense. So I am not saying to ignore the recommendations to introduce early and often. I do think if your baby is high risk, yes, it is an important part of the equation, but it's even more important, I think, in those cases then to support their body holistically, right? Supporting their gut, supporting their microbiome, because we know there is research, whatever, evidence to suggest the link between the microbiome and food allergies, for example. So that is one thing that it just, I wish it was talked about. If you Google what causes food allergies, you will not get a clear answer. They're like, we don't know. It's like, what? Or are you just not studying it, like the connections, you know what I mean? And obviously we don't have to talk about all that, but
It's so multifactorial. And like you said, okay, so your son is on the majority side of what like most infants will be at, which is, you know, not high risk for this. I feel like Sunday, my daughter is on this like more medium. Maybe she's not high, but she's medium because she does seem to have, well, I mean, it's complicated for her about her reflux because she has laryngeal malacia, but she does seem to have a clear egg thing. Okay. So, and then also she has had some, you know, mild, but they're there, eczema patches that kind of come and go. So there's a difference here between our two babies. And obviously there's lots of differences, but you know what I'm saying? So it would behoove me to dig deeper and figure out why is this happening with her? You know, what is it that's contributing to these factors and giving her probiotics and things, which I do. So there is things to be done to these children because it is like, what is making a baby high risk? That is the deeper question.
Yes.
When we're evaluating all of this. Well, like why though? But why is your baby already high risk in this situation? And supporting those and that being your base level line of thinking going throughout their childhood too, because you're right. There is an absolute connection between food allergies food allergies for sure too, but for sure we call it the allergic triad or the autoimmune triad, right? Atopic. So like atopy, so eczema, and then a kid gets a little bit older, and then in their early childhood years, they have asthma, and then in their adulthood, they have autoimmune disease. This is a very clear pattern that we see, and what it is an overactive and inappropriate response of the immune system. So why is that happening? There's a lot of different reasons why this could be happening. So we need to be taking all of this. That's why you're saying holistic, meaning like whole picture, taking all of this information into account and looking at these guidelines within an individual eye for you and your baby. Like, do you need to panic because your 7 month old hasn't had peanuts yet and they're low risk for all this kind of stuff? No, like calm down.
And that's not even in the guidelines. The guidelines say for a low risk baby, introduce freely. Isn't that interesting?
Like, and that may not even be that in that first year span. Because, okay, like you said too, that just because you don't give peanuts means that they're going to have an allergy to peanuts. Yeah. It reminds me of this idea that like there's so many different kinds of food in the world, guys, that like you've never eaten, okay?
Yeah.
And if you as an adult go eat, I can't even think of an example because I don't even know, but like some kind of random fruit that grows in the rainforest or something or whatever, and you've never had it in your entire life, it doesn't mean that you're going to like develop an allergy to it just because you've never had it. Yeah. But there are these high allergen foods, you know, yeah, like the soy, dairy, eggs, peanuts, shellfish, wheat, sesame. What am I forgetting? Maybe that's pretty much most of them. But that's because they are highly processed in everything. There is – these kinds of foods are all around us and they're in everything. And so they are more likely to – be something that if you maybe aren't having a proper integrity of your gut lining, then these molecules are getting in and they're, you're getting exposed to them, all these different forms. They're highly, you know, modified GMO, whatever it is, they're sprayed, da, da, da. There's lots of different reasons. Again, we don't know because it is so multifactorial. It's kind of like something, you know, like ASD, so autism spectrum disorders. There's so many different things that go into it. It's not just one thing or just this one thing. With these, and that's also an immune complex or a highly immune, influenced disease or disorder or whatever. And same thing with this, like what we're talking about. So I just wanted to highlight that for a second, that maybe for like me with Sunday, it will behoove me to be thinking about cognitively introducing these things for her because she is a little bit on that borderline. And there's, you know, I am doing some things I could be doing better to support her even further. For why it is that she's had this like little bit of, you know, but it doesn't mean that she's on this track of chronic illness for her whole life or anything, but I am being cognizant about it and we're learning and we're educated about. So anyway, I just wanted to pop in and say that.
I love that. Yeah. I think that there's no harm in introducing early and often. I would say then being mindful though about what we are, So when we're introducing wheat, ideally it's going to be organic, not wheat that's got glyphosate or I don't know if I can say that word on this podcast.
Yes, do it. Say it.
Big egg will come after us, but you know what I mean? Like being mindful to, so that when we are introducing these foods, that they are supporting gut integrity, supporting gut health, being and overall supportive.
Yeah. You're choosing the cleanest form of that food to give. And I mean, there's so much that goes into this, but yes, like you're hopefully you're choosing eggs that are not like a Tyson chicken factory egg, that maybe you're going out of your way to try to get some higher quality eggs that are of chickens that eat the things that chickens should eat and, you know, et cetera. This sounds like common sense when we break it all down, but it's really just not the way that modern society is set up anymore. So we have to be making these intentional choices in order for it to happen. I wanted to ask you too, how does a parent kind of determine a true food allergy versus maybe just like an intolerance? And what if, like, you know, when they eat the food, this is so common, when they eat a food, nothing else happens, but like their mouth gets all red. Like, what's that? And blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Like, you know, because there's so many things I think people will think like, oh my God, that's an allergy. It's like, I can never get that food again. And it just may not be true.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always, anytime this comes up and someone messages me or asks, you know, in my course community group, ultimately, I say it's best to work with a provider who can kind of work closely with you. And the reason is because they're going to take a full history. So it really comes down to the biggest thing is with a true food allergy, it is the immune system having that overactive or inappropriate immune response, right, to something that it shouldn't, to a food. Whereas an intolerance is more of like primarily involving like digestion, and it's not involving the immune system. And in general, it's like the biggest kind of differentiating factor in general. Obviously, there are certain different, there are cases when it's not this, whatever. True food allergies tend to be immediate and they can happen within minutes to within, 2 hours, whereas a food intolerance, it tends to be a little bit more delayed. Obviously, in the case of like FPIs, and we can get into like the nitty gritty, which we don't have to do here. But the biggest thing is, in general, it's a food allergy. The baby's going to react like almost immediately. And the reaction in general, like if they have hives, for example, if their hives are lasting 5 days, like that likely probably wasn't from eating a food. So it can be hard because I feel like when parents are starting to introduce foods and their baby has any type of reaction, it's just like we're so afraid of food allergies that we're like, it might be from that food. And sorry, that's why I say, like, if your baby has any type of reaction, write down the food and how long after. That is the most important piece of information, because if you are going to end up working with an allergist or, a practitioner, they're going to want to know, you have to know the specific food, because allergy testing, we don't have to get into that, but it's not always the most accurate. There's a lot of false positives. So that can obviously lead to issues and unnecessary restriction of not eating certain foods, but how long after, and then the type of food. So that's kind of the biggest thing. Obviously, there can be some crossover in symptoms, but
that's a really good tip. Thank you for that. That, like, just that one thing. Also, another tip in the same breath is, I always tell parents, make sure that you have infant Benadryl or pediatric Benadryl.
Or Zyrtec. I like Zyrtec because it's harder to, it's just like one dose. You don't have to wait. You don't have to, dose it by weight.
Oh yeah. And it's like easier, smarter, just quicker in that way, but to have something so that you can mediate the response if your baby is starting to have a problem. And then of course, know what to do. Also, it won't usually be on the first exposure. Mm-hmm. It's going to be on a subsequent exposure because their body has made a sensitization to it.
Yep.
And it could look small. Like, what was that?
Yep. And that's why I like to start small. Just start when you're giving allergenic foods, start with just a small amount and then work your way up.
Yes. Yeah. Like just a tiny bit of a nut butter, maybe on a spoon along with something else that they know, is safe or whatever it is. And what was I going to say is, in terms of symptoms, yeah, like you can look them up, but things like hives or problems breathing or splotchy skin, wheezing, vomiting, these all can be signs of anaphylaxis, which would need and warrant immediate medical attention, of course.
Yep.
FPIs and other intolerances can also have some of that, like with the vomiting, at least, where it's not going to be something that's anaphylactic, but your kid is definitely not tolerating it well. FPIs, if nobody knows what that is, it's FPIES, food protein induced enterocolitis syndrome.
Yep.
Okay. Whew, that's a tongue tie. And it's a short-lived one. When does FPIs, like most kids grow out of FPIs by what age-ish?
Like 3 or 4.
Okay, 3 or 4. So if your kid maybe – so Sloan, my 3-year-old, and we haven't reintroduced avocado with her since she's been 8 months old because she had an FPIs reaction to avocado, which I think is like not that common.
It's one of them though.
It's one of them. It's like I was thinking, oh gosh, is this like a latex allergy? But she handled bananas. She handled other things that were kind of in that latex, kiwi, whatever, family, okay. But with the FPIs, she would eat it. And then within like 2 hours, she would vomit for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. Totally happy and fine. She was like happy, but she would just puke all night long. And it was just wow, this is nuts. One time, the last time that she ever had any, there was the teeniest, tiniest amount of avocado on the tip of a fork that my husband was trying to give her a piece of chicken that was also on the tip of the fork. And he put it in her mouth. And I was like, no, there was avocado on that because it was like guacamole or something.
Yeah.
And so then he took a paper towel and wiped her tongue completely clean of it. And she still vomited all night long. I know, it was wild. So anyways, but we need to retest her. I'm sure that it's fine now, but we just haven't because I'm like, I don't really want to go through with a night of vomiting if I don't have to.
Yeah, I get that.
And then other intolerances too can present as, well, just because your baby has a little bit of a rash around their mouth doesn't necessarily mean it's intolerant.
Yeah.
It could just be that these things are irritating to their skin and their skin is delicate. And especially if it's like a citrusy fruit or acidic or something like that. So I think we need to have a little bit more symptomatic presentation mm-hmm. to be determining something like that. But I know a lot of parents will be really worried about that. And also, in infant skin, I mean, rashes, I think, in the pediatric world are like the most infuriating things because it's so hard to tell. I mean, hives are pretty dang obvious.
Yeah.
But otherwise, like, sometimes there's like those pre-eczema patches. Sometimes there's a little rough skin here and there. Sometimes it's like red and then literally 5 minutes later, it's gone. And so, you know, and so it can be a little tricky. Or, you know, now that they're starting to intake food, there's stool changes and then the stool can be acidic. And if it sits in their diaper for just even a few minutes, it can really make their bum all red. And, you know, things like that don't necessarily yep. mean that it's an intolerance, but it is in a constellation of other symptoms. It can be a symptom that's like, okay, maybe yeah. we're not handling this, right? Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's great. Yeah. There's so much to it. Like we could talk. There's so much to it. So that's definitely like learn what you can. Understand how to deal with the reactions, understand what to look for. That's going to be the biggest thing because it can be scary. And we also don't want to be afraid of food. We don't want to be avoiding foods unnecessarily because, you know, our baby got a little tiny rash that's like in an isolated spot. And then we're worried about anaphylaxis. Like that's, it's hard to. I always say anytime someone comes to me and they're like, what should I do? I'm like, I cannot tell you because it really is specific to like your baby's situation. And also there's the liability thing, right? Like working right. with food allergies, it's a lot and it can be scary. And, you know, that's why I just advocate for learning as much as you can so that you feel confident and you know how to handle it. And then you just, and like in most cases, like I always like to encourage moms too. Like if your baby does have a reaction, there are ways you can work with an allergist. You can help kind of desensitize them so that it's not going to be the scary lifelong reaction. And in many cases, they outgrow them. So it's like nerve-wracking, but I don't want to say, super rare, but for most babies, like they do just fine.
Yes, that's great. I think – there's still, we probably need to have a part 2 at some point here, but we'll have to wrap it up now. I do just want to leave really quick before I talk about your course. Speaking of that, about it doesn't have to be your like a life sentence for this child. My niece, up until she was maybe like 9 or 10, was anaphylactically allergic to all nuts besides peanuts. And like so much so that my mother-in-law one time ate a cashew, an hour later kissed her on the cheek and she broke out in full body hives. I mean, we had, you know, EpiPens all over the place. Everyone who was a care provider for her or in her space knew how to use the EpiPens, where they were, et cetera. It was very, very, very sensitive and bad. And she underwent this, like a small low dose immune therapy where yep. she was swallowing capsules of very, very small amounts of the nuts over a period of time. In the presence of the allergist and working with these doctors. And it was an intense program and it took a long time. Now, every day she drinks a cup of this like multi-blend nut milk to keep her body kind of like on it. And she has no reaction. She can eat all of them. She's completely safe. Like the coolest thing ever because
that's stressful amazing.
Life. Yeah. For the parents. I mean, and she's a twin too. And the twin does not have these things. And it's like, can you imagine doing something simple, like going to a fair and wanting to get some food for while you're at the fair with your family, which not like it's great food anyways, but not knowing exactly every single ingredient yeah. and having that fear that your child's going to have an anaphylactic reaction. Like it doesn't have to be this way for your whole life. So there are things to do. So I love that you brought up that point. But then just to wrap it up, I really want to encourage people to go to thrivingfoundations.org, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Thrivingfoundations.org.
And I'm going to put your information in the show notes as well. Your Instagram handle is extremely informative as well. You have a free guide on the first foods and then all of your course information there. And I just think that it's so much more than, you know, like teaching your baby how to eat. It's like a foundational health course and really, really impressive. So great work. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. And we appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much. It was so great to be here. And just thank you. I hope this is helpful. I hope it's encouraging moms to just feel empowered and ready and at ease, but also like ready to do this in a way that is intentional. And I always say, like, you don't have to, it's not about perfection. It's not about being perfect. It's just about being intentional, because then we can make those balanced decisions and make our macaroni with our sausage and, you know, not have to worry about when we're giving our baby a pouch, because we know we're not doing it all the time. So yeah, yes, we'd love to, we'll link the free guide, and that's a great place to start. And if you have any questions, reach out to either one of us.
Thank you. We have a special offer from Dr. Alyssa just for you podcast listeners. She has extended a 30% off coupon on all of her available Thriving Foundations courses, including her bundles and payment plans, using the code HEALTHYMOTHER. Again, just for you, 30% off of everything that Thriving Foundations has to offer, using code HEALTHYMOTHER, with the links in the show notes. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.